and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too, I must have this thing. Tonight, Mike M. comes from living in the Solutions Group on Northside Drive near Paces, near West Paces Ferry. My sponsor has been attending their Saturday morning meeting, and he's heard Michael share, and he thought he would be a great contributor here with our lineup of speakers. Please give Michael a warm nab of welcome.
Good evening. I'm Michael, and I am an alcoholic. It's good to be here. I always enjoy any opportunity I can have to be of service and to give back. And when Tim came up to me after meeting and said, would you be willing to share your story at NAB, I said, absolutely. I got drummed into me at a very early age that if AA calls, you answer, and that's it. And I've tried to live that way. A little bit about me. My wife was out shopping a couple of months ago, and she ran across one of those little embroidered pillows that had a saying on it that she thought was quite humorous, and I did too, and it seemed to encapsulate the my drinking. And it said that the trouble with trouble is it starts out as fun. And that was exactly my story. I was born in Chicago, raised in the suburbs. My parents were of the greatest generation. My dad was born in 1909. My mom was born in 1912. My dad had the misfortune of going through both the Depression and World War II. And I think, frankly, that left him a little bitter on occasion because he, about 2 weeks after he was drafted into the service, they passed a regulation that said anybody who was 33 and married didn't have to be in, and he was 33 and married. And so, and he had to drop out of college in Chicago and couldn't finish his education. And some of his friends who didn't have to serve in the military went on to be very financially successful. But that's a side story. What really was important was that I believe my maternal grandfather was an alcoholic. They never told me he was, and I never thought to ask, but I heard these stories about, well, your dad used to drink, and I supposedly found him when I was three, dead. I don't remember that, but my mother was definitely an alcoholic. And my dad probably was, although he was able to, in a lot of ways, control his drinking, and when he'd have too much drink, he'd get mean as a snake. And my parents had, you know, I was born in 1946, so that was 8 years after, I'm that old. I'm not able to stand. Come on. Anyway, it was at that age, you know, AA was only 8 years old, and it was shortly, you know, 5 years before that, Jack Alexander published his article in Saturday Evening Post or Look or whatever publication it was about AA. And people didn't understand alcoholism, at least my parents didn't understand alcoholism at that time. To me, an alcoholic, as described by my parents, was the guy who stopped your car at the stoplight with a squeegee and cleaned your windows and said, give me some money for dinner. That was an alcoholic. And a drug addict, oh my God, you know, anybody who messed with drugs, they were the lowest of the low. Having said that, every night my parents would have two martinis and if they were lucky, and their behavior would change. So, and they were of that generation. I don't know if anybody has parents like this, but they were the generation which kind of said, you know, if you're going to drink, you might as well drink at home because we'd like to know where you are. So it was no big deal if I drank at home. And I don't remember when my first drink it was. I suspect I was, you know, very young, maybe 7, 8 years old, just trying it. But I do remember when my first drunk was. And I'm guessing I was somewhere between 10 and 13. We went to the graduation ceremony of my parents' best friend's daughter. And I helped clean up the room after or during the party. And, of course, as I picked up the glasses, what did I do? I drank them. You got it. I drank them. And I got really, really drunk. And I went out on the front yard, and I puked all over their front yard. And everybody thought it was cute that little Michael, who's however old I was, had too much to drink and wasn't that sweet. And the next morning, I got up and I felt fine. And I remember going into my mother, who was terribly hungover and was a sight to behold. I said to her, it was terrific last night. Man, I just had a great time and I feel great this morning. And I'll never forget, because unfortunately my mother had a gum disease at an early age. She lost all her teeth when she was a young woman, and she would sleep without her teeth. So she looked up at me and said, just wait. And it was kind of prophetic. And there are certain memories you don't forget, and that's one of them. And she, little did I know, but she was right. I do have a lot of vivid and very unpleasant memories of pulling my parents apart in fights where my dad was choking my mom and banging her against the wall because she'd gotten drunk and embarrassed the hell out of him. I remember on several occasions picking my mother up off the bathroom floor because she had passed out and she was puking in the toilet, and carrying her or helping her get to the bed, and it was very unpleasant. But they weren't alcoholics because they had a car and a house. Well, two cars, actually, so we clearly couldn't be alcoholics. I went to a Catholic high school and by choice, and I don't know why, but I mean, for some reason, you know, false IDs, I went 60 to 64, I was in high school, so false IDs were not easy to get. It just really didn't occur to me. And we didn't have a lot of drinking. The Christian Brothers were pretty strict. And I was a good student and a two-sport athlete, so I didn't really think much about drinking. So I probably drank, you know, at home and had wine with dinner or a scotch every now and then. But I don't remember, you know, like when I listen to my daughter, who's 4 years sober and sitting over there, about her high school experience, it was, you know, like a very different. My memory is very different. I mean, I don't remember those big drinking bouts. But when I got to college, things changed. When I went to University of Illinois undergraduate school, and I got down there, and they had places that served beer to anybody who could walk, you know. And if you couldn't walk, somebody could hand you something. If you could just get to the bar, they'd serve you. And it became a very, you know, Friday and Saturday nights were a very big drinking occasion, and I drank. And I started to mistake the clear road signs, or what I know today to be clear red lights, big red lights, that I was an alcoholic with why I wasn't an alcoholic. Because I could drink a lot. I mean, I could drink a lot. In fact, when I got later in drinking, when I'd go out with people who I didn't really know, I always made sure they had one more drink than I had, because I figured that they would be really embarrassed to talk about it, and if I did something stupid, they wouldn't say anything, because they just kind of, you know, attributed to the fact that they were drunk. And that was kind of my MO. But I figured, well, okay, I drink a lot, so I can't possibly be an alcoholic. I mean, you know, if you can polish off a quart of scotch in a night drinking, you can't be an alcoholic, right? I was a good student in college and in graduate school. You know, I graduated with honors, and so how can I drink a lot and be an honors student and be an alcoholic? You know, but I got in trouble. I was arrested several times. Each time was drinking, and the old saying is true: I didn't get in trouble every time I drank, but every time I got in trouble, I was drinking. But even that was, you know, a joke. I used to steal stuff. Now, I never stole it for the money. I stole it for the adventure. Like, I went into a police station once drunk with a friend of mine, and we stole their softball trophy. While he talked to the sergeant at the desk, I was opening up the cabinet and stealing their softball trophy, and then we packed it up, mailed it back to them, and said that they should check their security measures. And then we got arrested one night, a friend of mine, the same guy. There's a theme there. He and I, he's now about 20 years sober. He and I would get drunk and raise hell. And one night we went to a bar and decided there was a painting on the wall that we wanted, so we took it. And we got pulled over by the cops at 4 o'clock in the morning. And turns out my friend had come home from Paris Island, and we were, quote, celebrating his return from Marine Corps boot camp. And the owner of the bar was an ex-Marine, so he said, as long as you return it, no charges pressed. And so I would get off. You know, I would do these things, and my parents were livid. I mean, I came home, and they said, you know, someday somebody's going to pull a gun and shoot you. It was 5 o'clock in the morning. And I thought, oh, go to hell, I'm going to bed. I remember I drove home from University of Illinois. I was about, 180 miles to my hometown, and I was trying to break my speed record getting home, which was somewhere around an hour and 45 minutes. And so I was really tearing. And I made a left turn onto a bridge, and to my astonishment, there was a big wall of white and black things with flashing lights on it because the bridge was out. And I slammed on the brakes, and it wasn't out, like there was something on the other side of the guardrails, but it was unpaved. And so, and I slammed through it, and I said, oh, my God. And I got and just destroyed the thing. And I got out, and I walked around the car, and I looked at it and said, oh, no problem. Don't see any damage. Drive home, 9 o'clock the following morning, my dad knocks on my door and says, come on downstairs. And I said, well, what's the problem? And I walk out, and I swear to God, there was a piece of this thing stuck in the passenger side door. And it was about 3 feet long, and it was white and black iridescent. And I missed it the night before. He had been alerted because the state police called to say, was there involved in an accident, because the truck driver had gotten my license plate. But I never had any real consequences, is the point. And that was my career, you know. And I got arrested once, but the guy with Art, but Art's dad had been in the police department of the local, in the local police department, and the cops were, cut us slack. And the judge was, when we went before the judge, he was laughing so hard at the bill of particulars as to what we'd done in our drunken state that he said, I wish I could let you guys go, but I got to charge you $50, so just get out of here, don't do it again. So I never, and then when I got into graduate school, I was always able to suck it up and not drink when I had to. When exams were on, when there was a presentation I had to do or whatever, I could do it, right? Now, Katie barred the door when I was done, I would, get drink. I think it's binge drinking. And I was able to control that stuff. I went to New York. I was in the advertising business, and I got into the advertising business because I either wanted to be a dentist or in advertising, and I wasn't sure. I decided I really didn't want to be a dentist, and I'd seen a movie with Rock Hudson and Doris Day. I think it was called Pillow Talk, where Rock Hudson gets out of a Chrysler LeBaron convertible at early in the morning after partying all night, goes up to his office, takes a shower in his office and puts on a beautiful new suit and conquers the day on Madison Avenue. And I said, that's what I want to do. So I, at a very young age, decided I was going to go into advertising, so I did. And I went to New York and worked in a number of big agencies in New York. I would have episodes of drinking where my ex-wife would be very upset because I wouldn't get home in time for dinner, and when I did get home, or for dinner party that we were going to go out to, and I would just go into the bedroom and pass out, and she took umbrage to that. But for the most part, I was able to control it for a while, and then I got to working with a couple of people who every night after work we would go to the bar down in the first floor of our office building. And we'd sit there and discuss the problems of the day. And we'd get loaded. And it went on like that. But again, it was like I was always able to deliver. I had a client one night. I showed up at a meeting. It was one of the best, most successful meetings of my career, meeting with the senior manager of the client side, my counterpart client. Said, I didn't think you were going to make it this morning. He said, why? He said, because the last thing I did was I saw you were, I used to have a thing for checker cabs in New York. They're the big kind of easy to get in and get out cabs. And he said, I saw you walking down the middle of Broadway at 47th Street trying to look for a checker cab and stopping one. He said, I thought you were going to get killed. But I showed up at 6 o'clock in the morning, and I set up the conference room, and I drank some coffee, and I got myself cleared up. I drank a whole handful of aspirin, and the meeting went off perfectly. And at 11:30, when the meeting was over, I took everybody out to lunch, and I got home about 1 o'clock in the morning. And that was the way I did things. In 1976, my ex and I were on our way out to we rented a summer house on Fire Island, and ironically, a drunk driver passed out at the wheel after a day at the National Guard, and he came across a median. The median was separated by bushes. It was an 8-lane divided highway, and it was so you couldn't see the other side. And I was on the very inside lane in a Volkswagen, and this guy passed out and came right through the bushes right in front of me. And I was banged up, not terribly bad. I mean, I had separated shoulders and a banged up knee, but my wife was in a coma for 2 weeks, and she had, last count, had about 15 operations and had to literally physically be pieced together. And that's an important part of my story because that was another part of my denial, because I called the people we shared the house with and said, you know, I've been in this horrible accident. They said, well, we'll come over from Fire Island. You have to take a ferry to go to Fire Island. And then I called my wife's best friend, and she said, I'll come right out from, she was living in Manhattan. And so she got in a train, came out, and, you know, and I was dealing with doctors and neurosurgeons and, you know, all this ugly stuff. And somebody said, well, I've got some Valium for you. You know, why don't you have some Valium? I said, no, I can't. You know, I got to be here. I got to be ready. And so, again, it was like I didn't drink. I didn't use Valium. When my wife finally came out of the coma and her mom, my mother-in-law at the time, came to relieve me, I then went, you know, she stayed at the hospital and I went to the summer house and proceeded to get drunk and fall off the boardwalk into poison ivy. And when I was 30 years old, preparing for a new business presentation with the door closed, putting calamine lotion all over my body so I wouldn't scratch and itch myself to death while I was making a presentation to a new client. But it was all in good fun. It just got worse. It never got better. I had a series of affairs, which I'm not proud of. All of them started when I was drinking. About 2 years after the accident, I was offered a job to go to the Philippines to be president general manager of a subsidiary of a company, American company over there, and I jumped at the chance. And in my gracious way, I said to my now ex-wife, I'm going. If you want to come, you're welcome. Otherwise, figure out what you want to do. And so she said, well, I'll come. And we figured it was a good thing because she was really having a hard time readjusting, you know, getting her memory back, learning how to write. I mean, it was really, really bad. And she was readjusting. And, I went over there and had a great time. I mean, we had a wonderful life. We had a lot of responsibility. And it was great. But again, how can I be an alcoholic? Because I've got an executive job. I've got all this other stuff. I've got all these people reporting to me. And I'm always able to suit up and show up. I would ignore little things like I broke my leg in a blackout. I was in a hotel room in Singapore on business, had to put my leg in a plastic bag, and I felt so awful I couldn't move. And all I could think of is I used to be able to do this. I've lost my willpower. I've got to figure out how do I get my willpower back. I used to be able to drink till 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning and still get up and hit the skids running at 8 o'clock and suit up and show up. And there reached a point when I just couldn't. I had, you know, more horrifically embarrassing episodes. I one time had a flight from Tokyo to Manila, which is about 6.5 hours. And my biggest client was on the plane with me, and he bought me a glass of wine for when they served the lunch. And I said, you know, I got a quart of scotch in my bag that I opened because I bought it to go into Tokyo because booze is so expensive in Japan. I said, why don't we have a drink from the... He said, well, they won't let you do that. You know, you got to buy the... I said, watch me. That's the last thing I remember until I came through customs. Now, the truth is, I don't know if any of you have seen Officer and a Gentleman, that movie. That was the Manila airport. It was a little bit better than that, but you had to walk across a tarmac, and you had to walk into kind of like a Quonset hut, get your bags, go through customs, and come out the other side. And I don't remember any of that. And, I mean, I was just terrified the next morning when I got up, and I said, oh, my God, I had my two biggest clients, president and the vice president of marketing, on the plane with me, and I didn't know what I'd done or said. And so I called the president and said, oh, I'm not sure I was very gracious in saying goodbye to you last night. I said, oh, he was laughing. He said, oh, no big deal. He said, I was so drunk I didn't bother to go into the office because I didn't want my employees to see me that way. And I called the vice president of marketing, who was a little bit less courageous. He said, I was so drunk I went to the office and slept on the desk because my wife would have killed me. And that was kind of, you know, but I learned. You know, I had a major presentation. We introduced Timex in the Philippines, and the president of Timex couldn't make the meeting, and I was a good friend of his, and he said, will you take over the introductions? And sure, and I did all that stuff. And it was an open bar. And the next morning, my biggest client had a launch party for one of their brands, and I was supposed to be there at 9 o'clock, and at about 9:15, I woke up, and I started yelling at my wife, why didn't you get me up? What the hell's wrong with you? And she said, you don't remember what happened last night. And I looked around the bedroom, and it was, I mean, it looked like a tornado had gone through there. She had had this wooden statue that had been carved for her up in the North Philippines, and it was in pieces. And she said, you don't remember that you had to be carried out of the men's room last night? No. And I tried to go to that launch party, and I got in the car, and I drove there, and I was so sick. I mean, it was just deadly sick. One of the worst hangovers I ever had. I wrote a note to the client and said, I'm very sorry I tried to be here. I'm just sick. But I learned. See, I would never again get up in the morning after a bender and ask my wife what happened. I would go take a shower first and try to piece it together. And I would look at my expense account statements or my receipts. If it was my last name ends in an R and I kind of do a flat line on the end of the R, if the receipt was ripped, I knew I was. So I had to be real careful. And I had a routine. I'd stand in the shower and I would say, okay, what do I remember from last night? Okay, I think that was 11. Okay, what time is it now? Okay, it's 7 o'clock in the morning. Okay, 8 hours to account for. And I'd sit there and I'd try to piece this together. And, you know, but then, of course, and then I came back to New York, and my ex had started a business there, which I was all in favor of because I thought it would be fun to live in the Philippines and she'd have a business and we could do that. And I went back to New York, and I was prone to being a little trigger happy with my language, and I was on home leave, and I had the interview with the head of the department in the New York office, and I was going to work for this guy, and he had a reputation of being kind of a jerk, and I had gone out to lunch, and I managed to kind of hold it to one glass of wine because I knew I didn't want to have too many, but I mean I just didn't want to have too many. And he had the temerity to ask me, he said, well, why should I make room for you to work for me when I know all these guys here and you're going to come in a senior position? And I remember looking at him and saying, well, why don't you tell me why the hell, after running a company for 3.5 years with more people reporting, three times as many people reporting to you, why shouldn't you be working for me? That was the start of our relationship. And later when I told him at dinner right before Christmas, that I thought he was a mean son of a bitch and loved torturing the people who worked for him, and that's why we had such a high turnover in the department. 2 weeks later, when he pulled me over and said, I'm not going to fire you, but you're not going to get the promotion I promised you, and you might want to look for a new job because I'm going to make your life hell, I was surprised. But all that time, I still thought I could suit up and show up. It got worse, and I ended up, through a series of job changes, I ended up with the guy I was working for when I went to the Philippines. Right before I got to the Philippines, I changed companies, hired me back. And I was working for him, and I was drinking really bad. And what happened was, instead of going, I always was an early person to work. I'd get in 6:30, 7 o'clock in the morning, and I'd work till 8, 9 o'clock at night regularly, and I'd work on weekends because I was, very driven and wanted to get ahead in my career, and it worked. But I started having to go in to catch up on the shit that I wasn't doing during the day. For the first bunch of years, it was always, I'm going to get ahead. Now it's, oh my God, I got to catch up. Oh my God, I didn't get that report done. Oh my God, what's the client going to say? I was smoking at the time, and you could smoke in cabs and things like that. And I remember, I had these beautiful suits, and they all had pinholes in the crotch because I'd light a match, and the sulfur would go, and so I was constantly having my suits rewoven. And I thought, I've had more pressure than this, but my hand's shaking. I went, it must be something going on. And I just couldn't. I wasn't connecting. And it was terrible. I mean, I was expecting that someday, soon they were going to knock down the door and to my office and drag me out with a big P on my chest for phony and parade me up and down Madison Avenue as just an absolute incompetent. In spite of a lot of successes, at one time I had the good fortune to own a brownstone in Chelsea. And I remember getting out of a cab one night, and I rented a couple floors so the rent roll covered the mortgage. So I'd as long as I had tenants, I was in like Flynn, right? I remember getting out of the cab one night, looking up at it, thinking, pretty soon I'm going to lose this. And I didn't feel, oh, that's awful. I felt relief. I said, oh, thank God. Pretty soon it's going to be over. It's going to be done. But it didn't stop me, and I had tricks in Manhattan. I would, as I said, we had to live in a brownstone, and you had to take the garbage out, and the garbage cans were on the street. Well, if I'd get home before my ex, and I would drink, I would always mark the bottle of wine, and I'd drink through to the next bottle to the point where she remembered the last bottle was. And then I'd take the empty bottle and I'd bury it in the middle of the garbage so that if she put it down on the stoop, it wouldn't clank. I never liked to lie to her too much. So when I'd come home and I'd have a scotch, I would get these big burgundy glasses that you drink wine in. I'd put some ice cubes in and I'd fill it with scotch. And I would never empty it. And I just keep topping it off. So if she'd say, how much did you have to drink? I'd say, one. And it was technically true. Things were getting really ugly, and I decided I wanted a divorce. So I went on September 30th, 1983, I went down to Lower Manhattan to meet with an attorney, a divorce attorney that somebody recommended, and I was talking to him, and I told him all the horrible things about my ex-wife, which weren't horrible. She was a very bright and very lovely woman. And at the end, I don't know why, but I felt compelled to say, she may claim that I'm an alcoholic because I drink too much. And without missing a beat, this guy said, why don't you go to AA? And he then proceeded to tell me a story. Now, I don't know if it was one of those stories that he was telling about himself in the guise of somebody else, or if it was true that it was about a friend. But he said, let me tell you a story. And he said, very good friend of mine is a very prominent, well-known attorney, written up in New York publications regularly, was an alcoholic. And he got so bad that I refused to talk to him. And he was my boyhood friend. He said, I gave him a ticket to London and a rehab appointment. And I said, go get sober or I'm never going to talk to you again. He said, that was 4 years ago, or whatever time frame was, and he's been sober ever since, and he's the new man, and he's my friend again, and it was no big deal. It worked. And I said, okay, well, that's interesting. And then the next night, in addition to having a wife, I had a girlfriend. And I was my ex-wife told me that she was going to go out to Connecticut for a party. So I figured, hot diggity, I'll go to my girlfriend's house, and I'll teach her how to drink good wine and eat good cheese. Because I like cheese and I like wine. And then my ex changed her plans at the last minute. She said, well, I'm coming home. Now, this was 1983. This was before cell phones, right? And so I said, okay, well, I'll just have to come home. Instead of staying overnight at Stephanie's house, I'll come home. And so I went out there, had the wine. You know, we had a good time, ate the cheese, all that kind of good stuff. And the last thing I remember that evening was standing in front of her liquor cabinet saying, I think I'll have one for the road. And I believe my last drink was either very early in the morning of October 1st, 1983, or very late September 30th. October 1st or very, very early October 2nd, 1983, when I had an old granddad. And the following morning, I woke up in her bedroom, fully clothed, terrified, thinking, oh, my God, you know, I want a divorce, but I don't want to terrify Ellen. And besides, if she figures out what I'm doing, it's going to be really nasty. It's going to cost me a ton of money. And, oh, it's awful. And, ugh. And so we went down. She said, can you drop me off at the grocery store? And I said, sure. So on the way to my car, she lived in a high rise out near JFK, which, for those who may not be familiar with New York, it's about an hour, give or take, depending on traffic, outside of New York. And she lived in a high rise, elevator, car parked on street. She said, I'm really glad you decided not to drive home last night. Okay. Yeah, yeah. She said, really had a hard time convincing you not to do that. Oh. Got all the way to the car before you decided to come back upstairs. Don't remember any of that. So I have to take her word for it. There's no reason for her to lie. We had to walk down the corridor, take an elevator six stories down, go out the front door, walk a block to my car, and I was fighting all the way, according to her. But she did something along with the attorney that probably saved my life. When she was getting out of the car, she stopped and looked at me and said, you know, Michael, sometimes you drink too much. And when you do, I don't like the person you become. And that kind of, like Friday, I heard from this guy who had no axe to grind. You know, everybody else said, why don't you stop drinking? You know, can't you control it? You know, and then my ex had said, we were driving to the beach about a month before this episode, and she said she was going to Al-Anon, and I almost drove off the road. I said, you're going to Al-Anon, for Christ's sake, everybody's going to think I'm an alcoholic. And she said, well, you're in the late stages of alcoholism. Oh, you're full of shit, you don't know what you're talking about. You know, so what I did was I went downstairs. We were at a hotel on the Jersey Shore, and she was upstairs reading, and I went downstairs and I got some vodka, because I was told, I hated vodka, but I was told that you couldn't smell that. So I got some vodka on the rocks, and I called my girlfriend. But that's a separate story. So between the attorney and the girlfriend, it was like there are two people who, they didn't judge me, they didn't say I was a bad person, they didn't yell at me, they didn't say do anything other than, you're a different person and you can be a different person if you stop drinking. So I went into my office, I drove, and I had a horrible hangover. So I decided, well, I'll be smart. I'll go to my athletic club, my health club. And I sat in the sauna for about an hour, and I just sweated and sweated and sweated. And then I went into my office, and I devised a plan. So I got to call my wife, tell her I'm okay. And I better have a trump card, just in case it gets a little bit too close. So I called AA, and I started getting resentments against AA right away, because when I called, the first guy I called, I said, well, you know, can you get me a meeting? He said, where do you live? I said, I live on the Lower West Side. I live in Chelsea. He said, oh, there's a meeting on West 72nd Street. I said, well, I really work in, you see, just go to the meeting. Okay. So I called my ex-wife, and I said, look, are you okay? And I said, yeah. You know, well, I know what it happened. A friend of mine called me at the office, a guy who worked for me. He said, I thought you'd be at the office. He said, where the hell were you last night? And I said, well, I was at a party, and I got drunk, and I didn't drive home. He said, yeah. I said, Ellen's just beside herself, doesn't know where you are. So I'm going to call her now. So I called her and said, I'll tell you, I'm okay, everything's fine, I'm coming home, I'll be home shortly. So I got home, and she greeted me at the door, and I said, I'm sorry, I went to a party last night, and I got drunk, and yeah, okay. And I said, I decided not to drive home. She said, oh, thank God, that's right. And I don't know why, but I played the trump card even though I didn't have to. I said, and I'm going to go to an AA meeting tonight. Oh, thank God. So I did, and I walked. I drove up there, parked the car, and got out of the car and proceeded to walk up to the church and was mortified because you people lied. Hanging on the push bar for the church door that was cracked open was a big sign with red letters about that high that said AA. And I said, this is supposed to be anonymous, goddammit. I don't believe it. So I walked down the street. And when I knew that there was nobody on either side, I darted into the church, and they had a greeter. He said, hi, are you new? And I didn't understand how he knew, but he said, I said, well, yeah, I said, this is my first meeting. And I sat in the back of the room, and they, you know, said, is anybody here for the first time? And I said, well, I didn't say anything. You know, and I was a borderline atheist. I was definitely agnostic at going to college and didn't like all the pomp and circumstance. That was my problem, not any religious problem. And then this guy got up and he lied bold-faced to the entire room. He said he had 5 years sobriety, that he was happy, and that it was the first drink that got you drunk. And I mean, I knew he had to be lying three times. You couldn't have 5 years, you couldn't be happy, and it took me a hell of a lot more than one drink to get drunk. So I got up and I was walking out, and the guy who had greeted me at the front door came up and handed me his card, and guess what? He was in the same business I was in. And he said, if you're interested, give me a call. I don't know why I kept coming back. Maybe they said at the meeting, keep coming back. I don't think so. But I did. And at first I had what I would call belligerent willingness. And interestingly enough, my daughter gave me this neat little bookmark, and there are all these little topics listed here. Acceptance, compassion, disease, inventory, insanity, prayer, willingness, etc. One topic is mentioned 23 times, and the next one is mentioned 12. So if you go on a simple math logic thing, if it's mentioned a lot of times, it's probably important. Guess which one's 23 times? Willingness. I wasn't like, oh, willing, give it to me. I was like, you sons of bitches better be right because I'm really sick of this shit. So you better fucking not be lying to me, goddammit. And that was my willingness. And I started getting what I call little victories. Okay? I remember I got in a debate with my boss at the office, and I did something. I hung in for something where I knew I was wrong, but I, you know, was just stupid, and I was really pissed. And I was going to this meeting on 90th between Madison and 5th, and I took a cab or a bus up there or whatever. But on the corner, as I was going to the meeting, was a bar. And I remember walking into that bar. I was under 90 days, and I remember thinking, I really want a drink. I really want a drink. This is fucking bullshit. And I'm sitting there or standing there. And I said, okay, these assholes said if I go to a meeting and I share, it's going to pass. And I apologize for the language, but that's what I was thinking. I mean, that was true the way I was thinking. I was angry. People used to move away from me in meetings because they kind of this cone of anger around me. And so I walked in. It was a huge meeting, probably 500 people, and it broke up into different meetings. And there was a beginner's meeting, and I went to the beginner's meeting. And the first time they had a chance to share, I shot my hand up and I said, here's our goddamn... Blah, blah, blah. And people came up to me after the meeting and we talked, and people I'd never seen before and hadn't, you know, some I probably saw after that, invited me out to dinner, and we had dinner, and it passed. And I said, well, okay, well, it worked there, but... And I kept on setting up these walls, setting up these tests, and damned if every time I didn't set up a test, it worked. And I do remember very clearly, you talk about coincidence. I used to travel a lot before I started getting sober. And I was about a week and a half sober when my boss came in and said, look, we got this big problem. It was on an alcoholic beverage account, interestingly enough. And you're the management person on this account. You got to stay here and fix it. So we're going to pull all your other assignments from you for the next 3 months. All you're going to do is work on this business, get it fixed, get new creative, get new media, do all that stuff. Management's coming over from Europe. Big presentation in December. You got to fix this. You're not going anywhere. So I went from, you know, 90 and 90. You got to be kidding me. Huh? Don't you know? But at some point, what really happened was I realized that the only place I felt comfortable in my own skin was in an AA meeting. I don't know when it happened, but at some point, it happened. And I do remember I was holding hands in a meeting at the end of the meeting, and I turned to get my coat, and a guy looking at me, I said, Mike, he's Michael. I used to play basketball with a guy. I said, let's go have, you know, what are you doing here? I said, well, I'm trying to get sober. He said, I got 18 months. I said, oh, terrific. I got 85 days or whatever it was. And he said, let's go have a cup of coffee. I said, okay. So I was so sick of Greek coffee shops are where you go if you're getting sober in Manhattan. I was so sick of them, I insisted we go to the St. Regis. And we sat there and drank $5 Cokes. And in 1883, that was a lot of money for a Coke. It still is, but it was ridiculous because I just had my standards. And Mike said to me, my sponsor says I need a sponsee. You're it. And I said, okay. And that was really the start because he introduced me to a bunch of meetings. And what I found was that if you are in Manhattan, at least, if you put a pin anywhere, if you throw a dart at Manhattan and you hit the island, not the water, but the island, there's probably a meeting within 3 blocks from wherever you are at some point in the day. So I went from I can't make 90 and 90 to probably making 200 to 250 meetings in the first 90 days. And I'm not saying that for self-aggrandizing, I say because that's the only place I could exist. I mean, I was like, I felt comfortable, I felt secure, and I like these people. They were great people. We would go out to dinner, we'd go to the 7 o'clock meeting at Regency at 86th and Park, then we'd all go out have dinner, then we'd come back for the 9:20 beginners meeting, then we'd go to the 11 o'clock 7th Street workshop, and it became my life. And there was a saying in New York AA, which is life is what happens between meetings. And that's kind of the way I did it. And all of the slogans and the cliches that I heard early on that made me angry and annoyed and wasn't that sophomoric and I could write a better statement than that in the big book have come true. I have not read anything in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous or the 12 and 12 that has not, in my experience or in observing people I've sponsored over the years, been true. And all the little cliches, I mean, you know, one of them was if I'd written my own story, I would have shortchanged myself. Absolutely. Never would have believed that I would have been graced with the life that I've gotten today. So I went from, and I started to do what people told me to do. You know, I heard early on, I can act my way to sober thinking, but I can't think my way to sober acting. And I was in therapy for 20 years or something like that before I got sober. 3 years into sobriety, I said, you know what? If I work the steps, I probably don't need the therapy. Now, I'm not saying you don't need, other people don't need that. For me, the steps worked. And I, you know, I was able to, you know, to cut back on that. But I went up to a guy in a meeting and I said, you know, I'm having a hard time with the spirituality stuff. I'm, you know, borderline atheist. How do I do this? And he said, just talk to God like he's your best friend. And I said, okay, I can do that. I said, cussing and all? He said, cussing and all. And so I remember very distinctly, I was having a hard time at the office. It was like 3 o'clock in the morning. I was trying to read the third step in the 12 and 12. And I was so what they call mocus in New York, which means messed up, and, you know, out of focus, that I couldn't get to the end of the sentence and remember what the beginning of the sentence was, literally. And I literally, physically just slid out of bed, and I got on my knees, and I said, God, if you're up there, take this bullshit away. And I got back into bed, and the next morning I got up, had a great day, and it was over. The fighting was over. There were other sayings that helped me immensely, that made sense to me, one of which was, my misery could always be refunded. You know, at the end of the day, the one thing I remember about the end of my drinking is that I was so disgusted with myself. I had absolutely violated every principle I had ever believed in. I was cash register honest, but that was about it. I couldn't look myself in the mirror. I just was disgusted with myself. And I thought I was, you know, had been this young rising star who everything I touched I was able to do, to the point where I couldn't show up at a meeting on time. My attitude was bad. If there's such a thing as an alchemist, as somebody who turns something into gold, I was a shitimist. You give me anything, I turn it into shit. I literally was in a meeting. I was about 18 months sober. I was in a meeting. And this was 84, whatever it was. So in the first New York State lottery, how am I on time? Anyway, okay. First New York State lottery was won. It was $5 million. And somebody said, you hear, the lottery got won. But two people won it, and I got depressed. I was not one of the winners, but I figured, man, wouldn't that be a bitch? You know, you win $5 million, you got to share it with somebody. That was evidence of how screwed up my thinking was. Anyway, fast forward, I've done everything since then, or just about everything since then, that I've been told to do. I've gotten sponsored. I've moved 4 times in sobriety. Every time I move, I get a home group immediately. I get a sponsor. I sponsor people. I make coffee. My sponsor just picked up his 30-year chip. In October, if I don't die or screw it up, I'll have 29 years. We were making coffee for 9 months in our home group. Why? Because it was what we were taught to do, and it works. I will wrap it up with one of my favorite personal sayings, which is, I always hear people saying, well, I'm getting a little away from the program. I stopped doing this, stopped doing that. I got to get back to the basics. So I always retort with, if you never leave the basics, you don't have to go back to them. So I encourage everybody, if it works, if you work it, you just got to give it time. It is the most wonderful experience I've ever had. My daughter, who is, as I said, 4 years sober, is just a wonderful testament to how the program can work. And I've had the privilege of watching her friends get sober, and they all, to a person, say when they come over, I didn't believe I could have this much fun without drugs and alcohol. So you can have more fun than you can possibly imagine if you just stay sober, trust God, clean house, and work the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you very much.
Shadow of death. Keep me out of the shadow of
of town.
From the bottom of my heart, and I'm searching for one star to shine. I will shout from mountain high, and I'll reach into the sky, till you open up my eyes so blind. But oh Lord, don't make it easy. Keep me working till I work it on out. But please, please, won't you shine enough light on me till I'm free from the shadow of doubt. Keep me out of the shadow of doubt.